Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolet.
Welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is our first on a new theme called Responding to Climate Risk, brought to you in partnership with the Australian Farm Institute. We still have a few more episodes to go on our Getting AgTech Ready theme in partnership with Decipher. So if you haven't checked those out, check out our last two episodes with Tim Rathis and Lockie Sutton, and stay tuned for a few more there, as well as more on this theme, Responding to Climate Risk. Our guest today is Annika Molesworth. Annika wears many hats. She's a researcher, speaker, writer, and farmer in far western New South Wales. In our chat, we cover the realities and challenges of diversification and Annika's experience with technologies and other practices that her family farm has been using to respond to climate risk. We also talk about how Annika's using technology to share her message and her family's story, and maybe most importantly, provide advice for the next generation and for consumers around agricultural advocacy and voting with your dollar. So here's Annika in our first episode on the Responding to Climate Risk theme, brought to you in partnership with the Australian Farm Institute.
I'm looking at how to recycle and revalue agricultural byproducts to improve soil fertility in irrigated cropping systems. So that means looking at animal manures, crop residues, biochars, how that improves soil fertility, and then the yield and the quality of the yield of crops like cotton and maize. And half of my study has been done in the Riverina of New South Wales, and the other half of it has been done in Cambodia in Southeast Asia.
I am super excited to talk about the differences and similarities between those two places. But before I do, what caused you to become passionate about this topic? And I guess maybe more importantly, what caused you to decide to really take action in the ways that you have around climate and climate change? Was there like a moment that happened where you said, I have to do something about this?
Yeah, actually, there kind of was. So my family purchased our Outback Sheep Station near Broken Hill in the year 2000. And the year 2000 was the start of the decade-long millennium drought. So we had purchased this property, you know, this gorgeous, raw, stark landscape out in far western New South Wales. We began designing what we were going to do out there, sort of researching sheep and cattle markets, bush tucker foods, and then really encountered 10 years of little to no rainfall. So our introduction to agriculture was quite a steep learning curve, and it became very quickly apparent to us just how interconnected different components of the farming system are. And as we all know, when the rain stops falling, less vegetation grows, livestock are sold at reduced weights, crop yields are not achieved, less money in the farmer's pocket means they search for off-farm employment. We see shops and schools and rural towns close. And then for the consumers in urban environments, we see food prices go up and food quality go down. So that really made me so aware, okay, we are in this really complex but interconnected web here. What we are doing on farm, you know, in these remote parts of Australia, has impacts to all aspects of society. It impacts everyone who eats food and wears clothes. So with this knowledge that this part of Australia was become hotter and drier due to climate change, that we would experience more frequent and intense droughts and dust storms, I became, you know, very conscious, okay, well, how am I going to upskill myself to take on my family farm and front up to these big challenges?
Wow, that must have been quite an experience for you and your family at that time. Had you guys been on different farming properties before, or was this a first foray into agriculture wholesale and this all happened? Like, what's a little bit of the backstory there?
We came from Melbourne, so we were very much city slickers. My parents had backgrounds in environment, so they you know, always had this desire to buy a farm one day, and we would, you know, dabble in farming. And, you know, we ended up with 10,000 acres in far western New South Wales, you know, in the semi-arid heartland of Australia, which is arguably some of the most challenging and fragile regions of the country. So we had to learn very quickly about our environment, about the impact we as farmers put, you know, on that environment, what we ask of it, how we are going to look after it the best way possible, how can we be the best land managers, understanding all the science, you know, doing our homework, trying to learn as much as we can so we were the best food producers possible for that property.
Wow. So what was that like? Like, I think one of the things I read about you was that at some point you guys decided to, you had to take action and actually do something different on the station to presumably deal with the drought. Was that driving the decision to convert to organic and look at different genetics, or did that decision come from somewhere else?
Yeah, so the drought opened our eyes and opened our mind to a variety of things. It highlighted how fragile this region is, and really made us look inside, you know, what can we do to, you know, farm sustainably for the future. And so we did a few things, really. We set up conservation reserves where we had identified rare and threatened species on the property, because we want to make sure their protection and regeneration. So we fenced them off to prevent grazing. It's a very water scarce environment out there in far western New South Wales. So we established dams and tried to improve our water security. And then we looked at what livestock species or varieties are suitable for that region. And 20 years ago, when we purchased the property, many people in the region were farming Hereford cattle, merinos, and we were one of the first ones to adopt African sheep, so Damara sheep, and then we slowly converted into Dorpa sheep. So these African sheep, they come from a similar semi-arid environment. They're extremely drought tolerant and hardy to high temperatures. They have a high birthing rate. So they were very well suited. We were also harvesting rangeland goats, which are the wild goats which just wander around far western New South Wales. The organic side of things, because far western New South Wales is naturally hot and dry, there is very little pests and diseases out there and worming problems and things like that. So we were organic by default, so to speak. We weren't drenching or worming our livestock. So we decided we would make that more official. We would go down the organics pathway, get our certification. At that point when we did it, it's quite a timely and costly process. It took about 3 years for us to go through the auditing and all the procedures to get our certification. And then it was also quite costly to actually maintain that certification. And because we are so remote, we're actually not a terribly large property for that region. We weren't covering the expenses of holding that organic certification. So we then ended up giving it up after a few years. So although we still run on organic based principles, we don't have the piece of paper saying we are officially organic.
So you've traveled around the world. You mentioned your PhD before and work in Southeast Asia. Tell me a little bit about the lessons maybe or insights you're seeing for farmers in the Riverina or in Australia more broadly from farmers in Southeast Asia or vice versa. Like, are there things that one side can learn from another, whether that's practices or technologies or what may have you?
Incredibly interesting. I mean, many of these farmers that I was working with, they had no formal education and no formal education in climate change, definitely. But they absolutely knew their environment and their land so well that they could describe to me, you know, the number of days that the dry season is extending each year. They could describe to me the insects that they're seeing eating their crops, which they had never seen before. So they knew so acutely how their environment and their world was changing. And they were so eager to learn how to deal with this.
And how, like, I imagine you would characterize the farmers in the Riverina quite differently for a number of obvious reasons. But in terms of awareness of climate, do you find the same kinds of things?
Look, I think because any farmer works and lives so closely with the environment, they are the first to feel the changes, you know, in their land, in their vegetation, in water availability. So I think it's undeniable that farmers right across Australia and the world are feeling the impacts of a changing climate. Whether someone to attribute that to human-induced climate change or not is a different matter. But definitely in Australia over the last decade, the conversation has absolutely changed and changed for the better. We're not seeing in the media the words like belief and debate anymore. It's very much about what strategies we need to be putting in place now. We need to ensure that there's national agricultural adaptation strategies put in place today. We're talking about climate and energy policies, and that's the conversations we absolutely need to be having.
In a couple of your talks and things, you talk about fragmentation, and is that what you mean, the kind of polarized conversation?
Probably more broadly is when I've been talking about fragmentation, it's more that, say, in Australia, and a global trend also, but in Australia, you know, a huge percent of our population are an urban dwelling population. Farmers make up only 1% of Australia's population, yet we provide 93% of the food consumed here. But when we've got a largely urban population who are becoming further disconnected from the people who grow their food and their fibre, they become further disconnected from the challenges that the farmers face also. Recently, I was in Sydney giving a presentation, and someone, you know, a well-meaning person, apologised to me for the rain that we were having in Sydney. And it sort of took me by surprise a bit, because we're in the middle of a terrible drought in rural Australia. You know, we haven't had decent rain for years and years, and we're absolutely feeling those impacts on my family's farm at the moment. But it just highlighted how disconnected people have become from our natural environment. And also that larger understanding of, okay, when the rain doesn't fall, that actually impacts the food that you're going to eat at the end of the day, and, you know, everyone who plays a role across that entire food system.
Definitely got it. Okay, that makes sense. And so obviously there are, I guess, two angles here around technology. One being, how do we overcome that fragmentation through technology? And that's a lot of the work that you're doing through videos and speaking and having influence despite living in a remote place and using technology. So I want to come back to that. But the other angle would be actual technologies that farmers can adopt to help be more climate resilient and farm sustainably despite the changing climate. Can you talk a little bit about any ag tech innovations that have maybe sparked your interest in relation to managing the impacts of climate change?
Yeah, well, I'll touch on the first point you made first in terms of like communicating the story of what's happening. And yeah, you're very right in saying that's something that I've become very interested in, how to actually, you know, bridge that urban-rural divide and actually reconnect people to the food systems and the people who grow their food. And that's something I've been doing online on social media platforms, you know, recording videos of myself, posting articles, writing blogs, and trying to engage people, because the farming sector has such an incredible, beautiful story to share. We live in these fantastic landscapes. We live with such a rich community sometimes. You know, there's this wonderful story that we as farmers can actually tell people. You know, tell them about how important their soil is and all these incredible microbes and fungi and bacteria that lives in their soil, and how that helps our plants grow and turn, you know, nutrients into nutrients that people can consume. And then, you know, relate that to the larger picture of, you know, the importance of rainfall and flowing rivers and, you know, looking after those river systems. So that's something I've been working with, you know, both by myself, you know, individually, through my platform, Climate Wise Agriculture, and through other groups like the Young Farming Champions and Farmers for Climate Action, really trying to amplify the voice of farmers in rural Australia and get these messages in the press. So in regards to communication technology, I think that's one really exciting place at the moment and something that's just opening up rural Australia to everyone else.
Yeah, before you go on to the more kind of on-farm tech point, I do want to discuss this a little bit. So I guess one, like the work you're doing is truly amazing, and I totally agree with everything you've said. One potential, I guess, pushback around that could be, that's a lot of work. Like if I'm a farmer and I'm busy farming, I don't also want to have to get on social media and tell these stories. Like, so what would your response to something like that be around the kind of, that's a lot of work, you know, why would I have to do that? And is that something that you think farmers really should be taking on in addition to producing food?
Yeah, look, I think the farmers I know, they have such pride for what they do and such love for their landscapes and, you know, their food they produce to high quality. You know, when I meet a farmer and ask them about, oh, you know, how's the crop growing, and I get a 30-minute, you know, response to that, farmers really do love talking about, you know, their animals, their crops, you know, the rainfall, the weather, and all of this. So I think farmers naturally have that, you know, that great storytelling ability and that desire to share with people what they do and why they're doing it. And I think now actually making sure farmers have the skills to access these platforms and tell that story, not just, you know, over the fence to the neighbour, but actually to a wider audience, to an audience that really wants to hear about where their food comes from. I think that's really exciting.
What kinds of ideas or technologies have you seen or innovations more broadly that are helping farmers to manage climate risk or adapt to climate change on farm? Ones that you've mentioned are kind of energy technologies. Are there others or do you want to dig in more to that you would say, you know, this is really going to be part of the solution?
Yeah. Okay. Well, on my family's farm, so we, in regards to climate change adaptation, and mitigation of emissions. So in terms of adaptation, we, like I mentioned, we observe some rare and threatened species. So we set up conservation reserves. So these conservation reserves are around some Eucalyptus gillii, which is curly leaf mallee. Now these trees have been dated to be around 800 to 900 years old on our property. And we noticed that there's no new seedlings of these trees. And that really, you know, raised concern for us. You know, what has changed in our environment so drastically that these trees that have lived for nearly 1,000 years old are bringing on no new generation? So we're working hard at, you know, actually protecting these species, raising awareness of these species that are incredibly vulnerable because we don't want to lose biodiversity. So that's something we're doing. We've established renewable energy, solar panels on our homestead roof. So we're using green energy to pump water to distant troughs, to sheep in the paddocks, to use, you know, solar energy to run our houses and all our electricity. What else were we doing? The genetics, so the African sheep. We've also partnered with universities because we're very interested in learning from scientists, you know, as much as we can about our property, our soils, our water, our vegetation, so we can best manage it. So the university is doing a series of climate change studies on our farm, which is incredibly interesting.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me is that some of those technologies and innovations sound like they could cost money and probably do cost money. And you've said before that, you know, technology, it's not about technology, it's not about money, it's not about knowledge, it's more about policy. Do you like maybe talk a little bit about how you see us enabling everyone to adopt some of these practices and technologies? Because I imagine for some it's cost prohibitive or the kind of worse before better dynamic is just too strong.
Yeah, well, focusing on say renewable energy as an example, you know, farmers are very positive about renewable energies and being a part of the solution here, because Australia, it is the sunniest and one of the windiest continents on Earth. There is just so much potential for renewable energies to be powering our businesses and also providing farmers with secondary and stable sources of income if they are the ones to host solar plants and wind turbines. Farmers have these great expanses of land. Let them not only feed and clothe the world, but help power it as well. So I think that's a really exciting place that we can be looking in agriculture and looking at ways to make sure that there are, you know, really good policies and, you know, regulations and strategies in place to allow farmers to play a part in the solutions to help with this new green energy production.
Do you give a lot of weight to the opportunity for premium brands and kind of differentiating, whether it's Brand Australia or actual brands, clean, green, growing middle class in Asia, et cetera? Do you see that as part of the solution to kind of climate resilience, either from a financial standpoint or practices that differentiate? And how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, absolutely. That could play a really important role. I mean, Aussie farmers are some of the best farmers in the world in the ways that we do produce food and fibre, and something that Australian farmers are incredibly proud of. Having some sort of labelling system or some sort of system that actually says this is what we're doing in terms of energy and water use and all of that, to actually put a stamp of this is how clean and green we actually are, that could be a really good marketing point and really, you know, encourage people to step up and really produce high environmental standard food and fibers.
So I wanted to just jump all the way back to the work in Asia versus the work in the Riverina. Why those two places, and are there, are you looking at different policies or technologies or practices that you can compare across them? Or how do those two things fit together?
Yeah, so what I'm looking at with my PhD is how to recycle and revalue agricultural byproducts. So in Southeast Asia, these smallholder farmers, they usually grow rice in the wet season for 6 months of the year when there's lots of rainfall, and then they've got the dry season where they get very little rainfall and they struggle to grow their dry season crops, be that maize or peanuts or things like that. And they often have a few livestock in the field as well. And what these smallholder farmers do particularly well is to recycle those livestock manures, put that into the soil to improve the crop growth. Those crop residues after harvest are then fed back to the livestock as feed. So it's very cyclical. There's very little wastage of nutrients and resources. In the Australian system, where we have become much larger scale, we've moved away from that traditional farming practice of using agricultural byproducts. We've moved away from using animal manures and crop residues as organic fertilizers and soil amendments. But because synthetic or inorganic fertilizers are becoming increasingly expensive, because more research is revealing, you know, some of the problems they cause, you know, when there's too much nutrient added to the soil and that's being lost into waterways and things like that, there's a lot of interest in returning to those organic amendments. Take it for the Riverina, poultry production is very large and also cotton production is very large. So my research was looking at, if we collected the manure from the poultry sheds and applied that to the cotton fields, do we get just as good yield and quality of fibre from the cotton if we were to use inorganic fertilisers? And the research so far is showing that it's pretty comparable, that when these nutrients are applied at the same rate, that we are getting just as good yields and quality of crop when we are using those organic manure fertilizers.
You challenge everyone to take responsibility, and you do that in a lot of ways, both explicitly in things like your TED Talk, but also in the work you do more implicitly in the responsibility that you take. Two angles there, just quickly before we wrap up. What do you think the role of farmers are in taking responsibility, and what's the role of consumers? And I guess I mean quite specifically. So yes, voting with your dollar makes sense, but what does that actually look like for consumers, and what do farmers need to be doing to take responsibility as well? And how do you see that?
Yeah, so look, my belief is that we're all responsible for our common home, for this planet. We all have an impact upon it. We are all accountable for our actions. And we don't get anywhere by pointing our fingers to someone else or another group and saying, you know, you guys are causing the problem. You guys have to fix it. I think that we all need to step up. We all need to, you know, channel our inner leader and go, okay, well, how am I going to make a difference? Maybe I can't change the world, but maybe I can change my world. And so that's when I ask people to find ways to help drive positive change. Because the enormity of the problems we are facing, the scale of the changes we are seeing, and by that I'm referring to we have a rapidly growing global population, we need to be producing more food with reduced environmental footprint on the backdrop of social change and climate change. How does each and every one of us step up to the plate? And three ways I think people can do that is by using, you know, your consumer influence, your political influence, and your social influence. So by using your consumer influence, we drive markets. And when we demand products with high environmental, social, ethical standards, then the producers, the suppliers of those goods and services, they have to step up or they get left behind. So I encourage people to, you know, put their money towards goods and services that are doing right by the planet. When I refer to using your political influence, it's about being informed where politicians and parties stand on environmental issues, but also asking them that, you know, we need strong and ambitious climate and energy and environmental policies. You know, no matter what the party, these issues are not political footballs. So we demand better. And then lastly, using your social influence, that's about amplifying your voice. It's about talking to people, getting these issues on people's radar, working with groups, you know, making a difference on the ground. And there are just so many ways, as we spoke about earlier, that you can amplify your own voice by using the social media channels, by writing blogs, by talking on the radio, by doing podcasts like this, by getting the messages out there, both the challenges that we are experiencing, but more importantly, the solutions that are out there.
Love it. One, I guess, clarification question, and I promised I wouldn't ask another, but I've lied. There's lots of confusion out there about labels and a lot of people and brands trying to market that they're, you know, environmentally friendly, or we only have this many hens per hectare or whatever. And I think it's really hard even for people who want to make good choices to distinguish. Do you have any thoughts on that or any advice?
Yeah, it is challenging. I totally agree. You go to the supermarket and you're bombarded with all these labels and decisions, and you just want to get out of the aisle at the end of the day. So look, there's a lot of resources online these days. I mean, we are so lucky that we're living in a time where we can access so much information. You know, obviously there's got to a point where there's probably too much information and, you know, you just feel overwhelmed. But if you can sit down and sort of inform yourself of where brands, where organizations stand in their, you know, social environmental responsibility, and try and make well-informed decisions where you can, then yeah, that's the best way.
Fair enough. Yes, we got to do our homework, and hopefully we can make those decisions easier and make the, like we said before, the practices that are worth rewarding more easily rewardable in various ways, technology or otherwise. Well, Annika, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate you sharing your insights and taking your time out of what is, I'm sure, a very busy schedule.
No problems at all. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of AgTech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.